Do you want to know how to value a company and what Julia Roberts has to do with it? Then listen to Bharat Kanodia in this episode number 73.
The beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So why was Julia Roberts selected to play the character in Pretty Woman? I mean, there are so many other women they could have selected. Why was she selected? Well, because the producer or the director liked her. She was fit for the role. That's why she's getting paid $20, $40 million, whatever she gets paid nowadays. So the same reason the founders are important, you have to see their track record. And you have to see that, hey, does the investor believe in this one founder or the co-founders? And what does the investment community think working with these founders is worth? Mm-hmm. Because that's really what you're valuing. There's no product. There's no revenue. So what you're really valuing is, what is it worth to me to work with Christian?
The evaluation is one of the most difficult exercises in the startup world. How can you put a price tag on a company that doesn't exist yet? Get help from an expert like Bharat Kanodia. Bharat has valued over 2,000 businesses and signed off on assets worth 2.6 trillion in value, which is basically the price of Apple. He has appraised unique assets like the Golden Gate Bridge, Atlanta Airport, Uber, Airbnb, Yahoo, Brooklyn Bridge, Mirage Casino, among many others. Bharat is the founder of Veristrat, a company that helps startup founders and VCs by telling them what their companies are worth. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with his family and enjoys sailing, golfing, skiing, and horseback riding. In this episode, we are talking about the history of entrepreneurship in San Francisco, failure culture, Julia Roberts, NFTs, and much, much more. This episode was recorded in January 2022, and I hope you enjoy the show the same way as I did. Welcome to a new episode of the Life Science Get Together podcast with another one of my favorite topics. I think since I do the podcast, I have a lot of favorite topics, I just realized. Today, we are talking about valuation and why it's necessary to put price tags on assets and how that work. And I'm very happy today to welcome Bharat Kanodia. He is from San Francisco, which in my opinion is the motherland of tech entrepreneurship. Bharat, welcome to the show.
Christian, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. And yes, San Francisco is, as they say, is a mad city inhabited for the most part by perfectly insane people.
San Francisco, let's talk a little bit about the history of San Francisco. I think it started in the 70s with Apple. That Apple and Microsoft that caught my eye back in the 80s as the first tech companies that evolved out of with this new spirit of entrepreneurship. Can you give a little bit more insights as an insider what evolved in the last 30, 40 years in your area?
Yeah, I mean, the boom really started in the 60s with Hewlett-Packard. And with the invention of the silicon chip, companies like Intel and others emerged out of here. And Stanford University has always been the biggest patron and supporter of technology and tech entrepreneurs. And it always helps when your patron has a $35 billion endowment fund. You know, that number hurts. And Stanford is really the engine behind technology boom, because most of the entrepreneurs come out of there. They also fund many of the companies. The VCs come out of there. They provide many incubators. So They provide research labs and space. So that really was the seed, if you will. And then also, let's not forget, San Francisco has always been the place where people who are not afraid to take risks go to. If you imagine, right, in the early to mid 1800s, it would take people 6 months to get to San Francisco. They would either, you know, come on wagons or on horse-drawn carriages or via ship. And they would have to endure the six-month-long journey and then get here and then make a life for themselves because there was nothing here. And they came pretty much empty-handed unless you were rich on the East Coast. And it is these founders and dreamers and entrepreneurs who discovered gold and started the gold rush, who discovered silver, started the silver rush, mm-hmm. who started the tech boom. So it's a combination of talent and capital and the zeal to make something happen.
That's very interesting. I never saw it that way, that San Francisco has a very long history of being a melting pot of the boldest of the bold, because it took so much time to travel there. And this is definitely nothing for people that are looking for security. And this might be really one of the routes why the area around Stanford still attracts such personalities. Can you talk a little bit about entrepreneurship in your area? How do you deal with failure culture? I mean, we have a lot of discussion here in Europe that we need different failure culture. How is it in the Bay Area?
Well, there's failure culture everywhere, you know, and I think failure culture is more in your head than anyplace else. The people that I have seen who are successful today are the ones who've tried many, many, many things. Mm-hmm. You try 10 things and one works. Literally, the success ratio is 10%. And there are many people who never take any risks. And yeah, they lead a life of security and happiness. And that's okay too, right? Not everybody wants the same thing. So to each their own. So I would say the failure culture or the success culture is less on the outside and more on the inside of the person, on how he or she gauges their success or failure in what they're doing.
That's, I think, a key point. It's an internal problem and not an external problem. So the responses from other people don't really matter. It's just how you perceive it. I think the key point, what you said, is that the success rate is only 10%. So 9 out of 10 attempts are bound to fail anyways in entrepreneurship.
So you have to be instead happy that, you know, if 4 of your ideas or 5 of your ideas did not work, great. 5 done. You got 4 more to go. And then you find the 10th one, which is going to be successful.
That's the right approach.
Other way of looking at it is, of course, you know, oh my God, I tried 4 or 5 things and nothing worked. Okay, I'm not going to try anything else. That's another way of looking at it. So again, it's all in your head. If the noise in your head stops, that's when you start listening to outside. So make sure you don't stop the noise in your head. Keep that going. Don't listen to outside.
Yeah, I think that I hope I can say it in the right way. There's this proverb from martial arts. The master failed more often than the apprentice ever tried. So I think this is the approach also in entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship, I think, is the core of your business, because people who want to play it safe don't have a problem with valuations. But the minute they say, I want to create something lasting, I want to create a business, they tap into one problem. They need investors. very often. And investors then ask one question. What is your business worth? Can you give us a little bit of background to your business? What is your profession in the Bay Area?
So I'm a valuation person. So nowadays, whenever you hear of a company or a founder or a startup, the first thing you hear is, oh, this company just raised $100 million at $2 billion valuation, or this company just IPO'd for $50 billion and raised $5 billion or something like that. There's somebody behind the scenes who is doing these evaluations, and that is somebody like me.
It's very interesting what you say. I wrote down the latest valuations that caught my eye. I think Apple is very interesting with, I think it's a little bit below 3 trillion again. It was a little bit above 3 trillion a couple of days ago. Then I also read today on LinkedIn that Y Combinator remodeled their investment approach to now invest $125,000 for 7%. And behind is also a valuation. And Andreessen Horowitz raised another $9 billion to invest in tech, was another one of the messages. And I think also they will have a lot of valuation problems. Can you explain in simple terms what valuations are for and how they work?
Well, sure. So basically, you know, when a company starts out, right, usually say, let's assume it's two smart guys, a great idea, and two laptops working out of a garage, right? What is that for? there's no product, there's no revenue, but it's two smart guys, an idea, and two laptops working out of a garage. What's that worth? Used to be that that is worth about $500,000. Now, that is worth about $1 million. So if they are looking to raise, say, $200,000, they have to give 20% of the company. Or if they're looking to raise $500,000, they have to give away 50% of their company. So it starts out this way now and then goes from there. Now, most times, the subsequent investors that come in, it is to their benefit to at least double the valuation at each inflection point. Because unless they're doubling the valuation, they're not showing to the external world that this company is growing significantly. And you want to be a part of it because, let's face it, right? Most startups, they never have a profit, right? And they're lucky if they have a product, or they're lucky if they have revenue. Yet, startups need to attract employees. They need to attract customers. They need to attract investors. And how would they do that? They do that by using a currency called valuations, because valuations tells the world, the employees, the investors, and the customers, how great they are, how awesome they are, that, oh, they just raised so-and-so money at $2 billion or $200 million valuation. Oh, they must be good. That's it, right? It's similar to your SAT scores or GMAT scores, right? Oh, you know, Christian scored 1400 on his GMAT. Oh, Christian must be smart. Well, yeah, but also not necessarily. Maybe he just knows how to crack the test, but that's the benchmark. So a great valuation is similar to standardized testing. Like TOEFL or GMAT or SATs or whatever you want to call them.
That are very interesting points, amazing points. When I was getting my master's degree in Austria in business management and economics, I learned a lot about valuations, about companies that are already have established businesses. So when I started working in listed companies,
we put price tags on basically everything we bought, and it was pretty, let's say, pretty simple, straightforward. You take the revenues, you look at the cost, and you have the remaining cash flow. You take the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years or an endless row of years. You assume a little bit of growth rate in stable industries, discount it back to now, and here we go, we have the value. Simplified. And then I moved into the startup world, and I thought, these models won't work because the companies don't have revenues. And very often the industries even don't exist yet because it's the first company that moves into that space. And I always wondered, how do valuations work in that area? What is your perception of this startup and scale-up area? How do you evaluate such companies?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by the constant stream of dire climate news? Turn that concern into action. Tune in to the Climate Confident podcast every Wednesday morning when I bring you good news and real solutions from the front lines of climate action. Whether you're in business, tech, or just passionate about sustainability, the Climate Confident podcast is your weekly dose of optimism and inspiration. Subscribe to Climate Confident on your favorite podcast platform and start your Wednesday with hope and actionable insights.
So, there are multiple ways of evaluating a company. One is you look at the cash flow this company is going to give you for the next 2, 5, 10 years. And you estimate that cash flow out 10 years, and then you present value it. That's called the income approach. That's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is like a sales comparison approach, where you're trying to find a similar company that was sold or bought. And you're saying that, okay, this company is the same as this company. And if this company was sold for $10 million, this company is worth $10 million. That's the second way of doing it. Or the third way of doing anything, valuing anything, is, okay, we have a company. What will it cost to build a similar company from the ground up? How much investment, how much cost will it take? That's the third way of doing it. Those are the traditional methods. When we're looking at startup, these three methods don't really work because the first method, the income approach, there's no revenue. There's no cash flow because there's no profit. Okay, so you can't use that. Second, it's hard to find a comparable because many of the startups are trailblazers. They are unique, or they might be even creating an industry as they go along. I mean, imagine valuing Facebook in 2004, 2005, and saying that, oh, it's a social media company. And people are like, what is a social media company? There's no industry. Facebook created the industry. And the third is, what will it cost to create something like Facebook? Dude, I don't know. $100 billion? Pick a number. You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm not smart enough. So the way you value startups is really two things. One is you value them on their revenue. So generally you would go, okay, you know, a similar company is selling for 3 times revenue, or 5 times revenue, or 10 times revenue, or 50 times revenue, or 100 times, whatever that number might be. Because there's no profit, so you can't use any underlying cash flow metrics. You always have to use a revenue number or the top line number. Another way of doing it is, this company makes enterprise software for utilities. Okay, great. I have another company that makes enterprise software for utilities. Okay, how many customers do they have? 5. How many customers do they have? 10. How much are they worth? 20 million. Okay. If they have 10 customers and they're worth 20 million, they might be worth at 5 customers, maybe 10 million. That's another way of doing it. So basically, you're trying to look for some kind of a metric that aligns you with a similar company in the same industry or in a comparable industry.
That's great. But they need already to have some sort of revenues, and there must be also some other companies. Let's go to your initial example with the two guys in the garage who are working. I mean, if I think Apple started this way and Microsoft started this way, the two crazy nerds in the garage, and they come to the conclusion they need some money and go to an investor, and they have no revenues, they have a pitch deck, they have an idea. And I always wondered how these guys negotiate then the deal. I mean, investor might say, good, I give you 10 million and 90% of your company is mine. But from what perspective? And then I read that Y Combinator takes 7% for $125,000 investment. So there is also a valuation included. What's your opinion on that? How do these people negotiate the value of the company?
So you have a book behind you, Atomic Habits, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here's another book by somebody I know.
Epic, right? Business.
Why is Atomic Habits so famous and this book not so famous? I've read both books. This book has great content also.
Mm-hmm.
Atomic Habits has great content also. But why is Atomic Habits literally on every bookshelf nowadays and everybody you speak to? You know, like back in the day, if you ask somebody, oh, have you read Seven Habits of Highly Effective People? Yes, I read it. Have you read it? Oh, you have to read it. It's one of those books, right? Or, you know, Good to Great, or, you know, The Da Vinci Code, right? I mean, all these books, why are some books so famous and others not? Or why do people pay $100 million or $200 million for a Picasso versus somebody might give you, I don't know, 20 bucks for this? If I told you this photograph was taken by Picasso, would you pay more? Why? If you say yes to that question, think about why.
Hmm.
And when there's no revenue, when there's no product and there's really no metric to gauge the valuation of a company, then it really boils down to two things. The founders, number one. What is their track record? Do you trust them? Do you think they can deliver what they say they're going to deliver? That's one. And two, some people find, I don't know, Pamela Anderson hot. Some people find Jennifer Lopez hot. Some people find Hugh Jackman hot. Why? I don't know. They have their own reasons. So the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Right? You might think Atomic Habits is a great book. I don't think it's a great book. That's not what I'm saying. I think it's a great book, but I could make a case that I don't like it. Sure. I'm not wrong. And you're not wrong either. The beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So why was Julia Roberts selected to play the character in Pretty Woman? I mean, there are so many other women they could have selected. Why was she selected? Well, because the producer or the director liked her. She was fit for the role. That's why she's getting paid $20, $40 million, whatever she gets paid nowadays. So the same reason the founders are important, you have to see their track record. And you have to see that, hey, does the investor believe in this one founder or the co-founders? And what does the investment community think working with these founders is worth? Mm-hmm. Because that's really what you're valuing. There's no product, there's no revenue. So what you're really valuing is, what is it worth to me to work with Christian? How do you value that? You can't. So then it comes down to, okay, well, I want to work with Christian. Christian, what do you want? How can I work with you? And Christian says, $10 million. And I say, no, $10 million is too much. How about five? And then Christian says, all right, let's settle on eight. I say, 7.5. All right, settle in a half. So at some point, it comes down to really negotiation and feeling and comfort and chemistry, or whatever you want to call it, the need and the want that I want to work with Christian. And Christian says, I want his $5 million. So the answer is somewhere in the middle. So when you don't have any other metric, you don't have any traditional metric, you know, it really is comes down to, hey, these two, three, four guys want to work together. How can they strike a deal?
And then it's negotiation. And
the starting point is $1 million.
Mm.
Two guys, two smart guys with an idea, with two laptops working out of a garage. Starting point is $1 million.
You mean million in valuation? So the first
evaluation. First of yes.
So this is basically the Y Combinator model then, where they say 7% for 125,000, a little bit more than $1 million, but
close enough.
Close enough. Okay. That's great. I mean, you brought the example. Let's move to another part of the industry that is also, I perceive it as a startup world. You brought up this picture example with Picasso. NFTs was something that caught my in the last year. I think the first that were pushing this topic in my world was Gary Vaynerchuk. 24/7 online, buy NFTs. And I thought, why should I pay something for digital pictures? And I think it was last year that I heard, or the year before last year, that Beavers sold every days for, if I remember it right, $65 million. What is the rationale, in your opinion, behind such values? Is it just psychology, or do you also see hard metrics behind it where you can tie down the price tag on that?
Do you own a domain name?
Yes.
What domain name do you own?
CS Life Science Invest, Life Science Get Together, something like that.
Well, CS Lifestyle Invest. A life science invest. What is that worth? How much did you buy it for? $10?
$10, something like that. Yeah. Something like that. I can't remember. It was pretty cheap.
Would you sell it for $10?
I need it. No. So
would you sell it for $50? $50,000. This is exactly what NFTs are. So NFTs today, we think, oh my God, what are NFTs? I don't understand it. It's like, oh my. 20 years ago, people had the same emotions about domain names.
Mm-hmm.
What is a domain name? I don't know. Where do you go buy it? I don't know. Well, that guy just sold a domain name for $1 million. What? I can buy a domain name for $10. What? If he can buy a domain name for $10, why is he paying $1 million for the domain name? Remember those conversations?
Mm-hmm.
Bill Gates had paid $1 million for the Microsoft.com domain name. And it's like, what? Bill Gates got so much money. Why is he wasting his money? I can buy Microsoft.com for $10. But well, wait, it's not available. Back in the day, terms like email or PDF or text messages, right? Or domain names were like, whoa, I don't understand this. I don't get it. But today, it's every day. We use these terms every day.
Mm-hmm.
And most people have at least one domain name, at least one. Similarly, NFTs today are new, and many people are not familiar with what they are or how they work. And especially around valuations, if they don't even know what they are and how they work, they are most confused about the valuations. Give it time. People will start understanding, right? People like now, even my father understands what a domain name is. 20 years ago, he did not. Even I did not. But now everybody does. Same thing with NFTs. NFTs are similar to domain names, except NFTs are really just smart contracts. You know, it's a higher level electronic asset. But the DNA, if you will, is similar. So back in the day, the whole thing was a land grab. They will just buy all the domain names you can, you know. I know people who used to own 5,000 domain names, you know, and then they just had this huge domain name bank and they would sell them one by one. People are doing the same thing. It's just a new asset class. So if NFL or NBA or Mark Wahlberg, they have all these assets all around the world, and they found a way to monetize the old films they have of plays, or the footage they have of them shooting certain scenes, which are very famous. And if they can sell those clips, yet have it contained and protected against copyright laws and against intruders or hackers, well, why not? It is a new asset class. I am more bullish on NFTs than I am on Bitcoin or something else. Similar to email and PDFs and domain names have stayed and stuck around for a long time. Mm-hmm. Do you remember a company called BlackBerry?
Yeah. Canadian company back in, yeah, I think 2005, 2006 with...
About them anymore?
A little bit lately in the security space, but not in the traditional smartphone space.
They're gone.
Mm.
Same thing. Sometimes specific asset for specific use come and go. But the idea, the concept, the tool, the asset class stays. Email is here to stay. PDFs are here to stay. NFTs are here to stay.
Mm.
Particular or specific cryptocurrencies, they might come and go.
That's interesting. When I look at YouTube, Bitcoin, let's stay a little bit with cryptocurrencies. Michael Saylor is one of the, how do they call it, Bitcoin maximalists, or Anthony Pompliano, who believe that Bitcoin might go higher than 1 million. What's your opinion on valuation of cryptocurrencies that are all over YouTube these days?
You know, they say like breeds like. If people want to believe something, whom am I to stop them?
Mm-hmm.
If they own so much Bitcoin, it is to their benefit to tell everybody that, hey, Bitcoin, buy Bitcoin, because that's how Bitcoin is going to increase in value. It's all supply and demand. There's no other use for it. So the only way the value will increase is by, if I tell you, Christian, you should buy Bitcoin. And if Christian buys Bitcoin, my Bitcoin's value will go up.
Mm-hmm.
That is why these guys are going on all podcasts and all news channels, and they're writing blogs, because they have to. They have to tell the world that buy Bitcoin. Because if they don't do that, nobody will buy and their value will not go up and they will look stupid. And they don't like to be looking stupid. So they want to tell the world, buy Bitcoin.
So
I, on the other hand, am not smart enough to tell you what Bitcoin is worth.
Hmm.
But I can tell you that traditional ways of valuation do not apply to Bitcoin, because there's no cash flow, there's no comparable currency, And what does it take to create Bitcoin? I don't know. So it is worth, it is like similar to buying a Picasso. Hey, why is Picasso $200 million? I don't know, because it's rare. And some idiot paid $200 million for the last Picasso. So now all Picassos are $100 million. Okay, great.
So it's more psychology than the technology. What I'm thinking about is transferring large amounts of money, so billions, for example. It's very complicated via the traditional banking system, in my opinion, still today. When you do it via Bitcoin, I mean, you can just, it's just a blink of an eye and you put it from wallet to wallet if you ignore the volatility. So there is some utility in the technology, but the value is also a mystery to me. When we switch to another industry, it's the industry that I'm familiar with, it's drug development. Also here, I think it's very easy to evaluate a drug that's on the market that creates cash flows, that creates revenues, where it's known how many patients are out there and also the profile of the drug. When we look very early in the area of tech transfer, so when the technology comes out of university and goes into the first corporate shell, then you read on the internet these amazing numbers. For example, BioNTech got an investment of $500 million, private round, far before the pandemic, from a European family office to move the mRNA technology forward. How do you see valuations in this pre-market drug development space? What models do you use to evaluate that?
So I have valued many pharma companies and many med device companies. And those valuations are very interesting and tricky. Because a drug, or I should say a molecule, could, valuation can be anywhere between zero and $10 billion. The answer is somewhere in the middle. Let's take the average. That's the right answer. So every molecule is worth $5 billion. Is that the right answer? No. But the answer is somewhere between zero and $10 billion. So how do you know what is the right answer? And usually you know the right answer based on assumptions and efficacy studies and, you know, many things that you can look into. At the end of the day, it is all an assumption done by a smart analyst like me, just crunching numbers on Excel sheets. But it is all based on efficacy and probability and cash flows and market penetration or market size. So, I mean, I can look at 10 molecules that help the same disease or same problem. And each of them can be worth zero or $10 billion. Or they could be worth negative because a company has to spend at least $200, $400, $500 million to get it to market, if they're able to get it to market. So those valuations are actually far more interesting. Life science or pharma valuations, mm-hmm. because, you know, they're also, you're almost assuming that, okay, how will this company do? And then, you know, on top of that, one pharma company, one life science company might have 2, 4, 6, 10 molecules in works at the same time. So one molecule might give you $20 billion. One molecule might give you zero. One molecule might give you $100 million. One molecule might give you 50,000. I don't know. So it is really you have to do a deep dive
into the clinical trials, how the drug is, molecule is doing, how the market is reacting, or how the trials are coming through, not just in the United States, around the world, because Europe has different laws than America and other parts of the world. And profitability studies are very different. And go-to-market strategies are very different. Same drug. And market size is very different. So those are far more involved than complex valuations.
That's, I think, when I put what you said initially together with what you said now, it's I think it's a good starting point also for life science founders. It all starts with 1 million. So the first company shall get $100,000 in, put the price tag of 1 million in. When you can convince a business angel or two or three business angels to invest 100,000, you have the first price tag. But afterward, the team needs to sit down and do their homework. So as you said, how many patients are out there? What's the competition? What's the time to market? Which clinical trials need to be conducted? How much are they worth? How much money does the team need? And this is really hard work and hardcore work. And very often, I think founders underestimate that. My recommendation is always get a professional on board like you are that helps you putting the model together and does also support on the market research side. What's your recommendation to founders? When should they start thinking about creating, let's say, rational models around the evaluation? What's the right point in time, in your opinion, after founding the first corporate chair?
They should and can hire somebody like me. But I want to highlight that even then, there's no 100% guarantee that they will have the right answer. Even I, with all the tools and all the experience that I have, I cannot look into the future. And nobody can. So basically, I'm using my skills, my talent, my experience, my tools to predict the future when I'm trying to value a drug company or a molecule or if it's or its efficacy. Now, my estimate is going to be better than yours because I do this all the time, but it's still not going to be 100% accurate. So, yes, they should hire somebody, a analyst or evaluation expert to help them, but it's still not necessary that they will find the right answer. They might be closer to the right answer than they were before, but it's not necessarily they find the right answer.
Yeah, but I also believe it's more an iteration process to come closer to the truth and to update the valuation model. I mean, what I like with the valuation work is that it's a clear set of rules to work through, and it helps the team, in my opinion, to prepare for investment pitches. At the end of the day, investors will simply ask the same questions. What's your market? How many patients are out there? What's your cost structure? What's the risk in the development? And if the team constantly refines the model, they are, in my opinion, on the safe side because they always have the right answers for investors. When I looked at your YouTube channel, you have a great channel. And when I thought about valuations, I'm always thinking in terms of businesses and in terms of drug development, medical devices, or putting a price tag on products. And I never, ever thought about putting price tags on things like the Eiffel Tower. And the first video that jumped into my eye on your YouTube channel was that you made a great video about putting a price tag on the Eiffel Tower. How does that work?
Again, Christian, the reason I can value all different kinds of assets and companies, unique assets and companies, is because you don't take your eye off the fundamentals. The fundamentals, they stay the same. It doesn't matter if it's Eiffel Tower or the Golden Gate Bridge or the Atlanta Airport or Uber or Airbnb. It doesn't matter. The fundamentals of valuations stay the same.
So I'm looking at Eiffel Tower. One way to look at it is, what will it cost to rebuild the Eiffel Tower today? One way to look at it is, what is a similar monument like Eiffel Tower anywhere else in the world costing today? Third way of looking at the Eiffel Tower is, if Eiffel Tower were a business and it's making you this much cash flow a year, it's making the French government this much cash flow a year, say if it's making the French government, I don't know, $100 million a year, what would you pay for a business that gives you $100 million cash flow? Very simple. Forget about it's the Eiffel Tower. No, don't let that cloud your judgment. Mm-hmm. Right? It's when we allow the external things to cloud our judgment, that's when we are not good at what we do. That's why I'm saying stick with the fundamentals. Don't take your eye off the fundamentals. If you stay with that, you won't go wrong. So you can value anything.
That's true. I never saw it that way. In the preparation to the podcast, you said you do a lot of, you have created nice life habits. Can we talk a little bit about that? How do you set up your day?
I have a major morning routine. I wake up at 4. I meditate for 45 minutes. I do yoga for 40 minutes. And then I read like a spiritual book for 30, 35 minutes. And then I shower and then I start my day at 6:30. I start working at 6:30. Mm-hmm. So from 4 to 6:30, I'm just within myself. I'm not talking to anybody. I don't look at my phone. I'm just spending time with myself. And during the day, I read like a business book when I have chance. Usually, I stop my meetings around 3:30. And so from 3:30 to 5:00, I either spend time with my children, I take them to the park, or if it's raining or if they're not in the mood to go to the park, I read like a business book. In the evening, I meditate again after dinner for 45 minutes again. And I also read a fiction book just to relax and decompress. And I watch TV, but I've cut back on watching TV because there's only bullshit on TV. It's all crap. And I love the book Atomic Habits. I think the book Atomic Habits is a very practical approach of how to do things, right? Everybody says, oh, Christian, don't get angry. Oh, Christian, lose weight. Oh, Christian, you should exercise. Well, Christian knows that. You know what I mean? I'm not telling Christian anything new. But how? Nobody tells Christian how. That book tells you how. That's why I really like that book.
I couldn't agree more. It's absolutely one of the best books I've ever read on that subject. When I think on New Year's resolutions, statistics I read lately was that by the second week of February, already about 80 to 90% of all New Year's resolutions failed. And my opinion also, this book tells people the reasons why. So setting big goals is a great thing, but running a marathon, for example, I hear that very often in my circle of friends that they want to run a marathon. It's a huge goal. How can you get started on running a marathon? And James Gear has the answer. Just do a little bit every day.
So, you know, back in the day when I used to work out, I would work out for hour and a half. Hardcore workout. And the next day I'm dead. Mm. I can't work out for 2 days because my body is hurting. Now I only work out. I actually do like physical yoga is only 20 minutes. Then I do breathing exercises and other things. The actual physical yoga is only 20 minutes. That's it. Because if I do more than that, I can't do yoga the next day. It's more important to be consistent. It's more important to do yoga every day or exercise every day than to do it for 1 hour or 2 hours one day and not do anything for 3 days. That's bad.
Habits and consistency. That's absolutely the right approach. And when we talk about consistency in business, let me ask you one last question for this podcast. when people hear the podcast and want to learn more from you about valuation, can you give us a little bit of insight into your business, which kind of services you offer, and how people can reach out to you with business requests?
Well, sure. I value companies, you know, when a founder or an entrepreneur is looking to raise capital, debt or equity, or they want to raise venture capital, they always need a valuation. Or if somebody's looking to sell a company, they need a valuation. And I help people. I help people internationally. So if it's Europe or America or Africa or Asia, it doesn't matter. Reach out to me. You can go to my YouTube channel and there's a link to the contact me button. And if you have a question, reach out. I'm always here and I enjoy helping people.
Bharat, thank you very much for your time and giving great insights into life habits and valuations. I wish you, your family and your team a prosperous 2022. And let's catch up in a couple of months and maybe we have a separate podcast on life habits again.
Sounds great, Christian. Thank you again for having me.
Have a great day. Bye. Thanks for listening. Please, please share the podcast and make sure you've subscribed. Have a great day.